If black people had decided to terrorize white brothers and sisters the way white brothers and sisters terrorized black people, every generation there'd have been a civil war. If black people had produced terrorists rather than Frederick Douglass, and terrorists rather than Martin Luther King Jr., and terrorists rather than Ella Baker, there would be no democratic experiment whatsoever. Let's be honest about it.
Welcome to Cambridge Forum in Harvard Square, but tonight's topic, race still matters. I'm Mary Stack, the director of Cambridge Forum, and tonight we are extremely pleased to have both the wit and wisdom of a true Renaissance man as our guest speaker in the form of Dr. Cornel West. A philosopher and theologian, West is currently professor of the practice of public philosophy at the Harvard Divinity School, yet he's a man who's built a reputation over the past 40 years as one of the most eloquent voices in America's racial debate. Tonight he's here rather ironically to mark the 25th anniversary and reissue of his book, Race Matters. This book was first published back in 1993 on the first anniversary of the LA riots, and it is now regarded as a classic read. But the new introduction to the latest book is much more chilling than its predecessor. West says, "We live in one of the darkest moments in American history, a bleak time of spiritual blackout and imperial meltdown." Dr. Cornel West.
This forum is not to be taken for granted. It's so very important that we have some high quality public spaces given the privatizing of nearly everything possible in our neoliberal regime. And the Cambridge Forum has a long and rich history of ensuring that our voices bounce up against one another. And I come from a people whose anthem is "Lift Every Voice." And those voices are requisite for any kind of democratic soul craft, any kind of democratic culture, let alone a full-fledged democratic experiment, given the realities of empire and white supremacy and male supremacy and homophobia and transphobia and all of those different ideologies that lose sight of precious human beings, the anti-Jewish, anti-Arab, anti-Palestinian, anti-Kurd. We can go on and on, because I'm here for some serious dialogue given the seriousness of our subject matter. And I begin actually on a very different note than most discourses about race. I begin with an acknowledgement that we live in a nation that's been shaped by a vicious legacy of white supremacy, but there is no white supremacy without resistance to white supremacy. And I am who I am because somebody loved me, somebody cared for me. So in the face of white supremacist attack, black hope, a joke, black freedom, a pipe dream, black history, a curse, black love, a crime. No, I come out of a tradition of a flawed people, but a people who have been serious about confronting the hatred of white supremacy and yet teaching the world so much about how to love. That's what John Coltrane's Love Supreme is all about. Marvin Gaye's What's Going On and the love-soaked essays of James Ball and Toni Morrison, Nina Simone. These are not icons to be invoked. They are constitutive features of a tradition that is shot through my heart, mind, and soul. So I begin with prophetic fight back, given the spiritual blackout. Now, what is spiritual blackout? What is the relative eclipse of integrity, honesty, decency, and generosity in our culture is shot through every institution, every site, every sphere. So when you talk about race matters, you're only talking about a particular tradition that's trying to reinforce the spiritual blackout. But we live not just in a democratic experiment, but we live in an empire. And that empire is in deep spiritual decay. And when I talk about spiritual blackout, I'm talking about one the normalizing of mendacity, where lies are viewed as the normal way of life. And I'm not just talking about a gangster at the top named Brother Donald Trump. That's too easy. He's not isolated. He's not alien. He's not extraneous to the American experiment. He is as American as apple pie. He just happens to be the worst of the American experiment. But he's not all by himself, and that's very important, because the last thing we need is to think that all we need to do is extricate some isolated individual, and lo and behold, we're able to get back to business as usual. No, business as usual already normalized mendacity. As I recall, it was Brennan that said, "Yes, we have drone strikes, and they have not killed one civilian." Quit lying. Yes, Wall Street is in fact accountable. We're going to ensure that the rule of law rules. Quit lying. No Wall Street executive went to jail. We know that, given that massive criminality of market manipulation, insider trading, fraudulent activity, and predatory lending. Lies, lies, lies. And when you normalize mendacity, you naturalize criminality. What used to be crimes against humanity, lo and behold, become business as usual. 22% of America's children living under poverty in the richest nation of the world, that's a crime against humanity. The top three individuals in America have wealth equivalent to the bottom 160 million fellow citizens. 50% of Americans have wealth equivalent to the top three brothers. That's a crime against humanity. Why use that hyperbolic language? Precisely because that level of grotesque wealth inequality generates forms of wounds and scars and bruises, unbelievable forms of terror and trauma, psychic as well as physical. And where are the righteous indignation expressions? Where are the voices? That's what it means to deal with, to have to come to terms with spiritual blackout. Now, thank God for the Poor People's Campaign, trying to keep alive what the Isley Brothers call a caravan of love. A love of truth and condition of truth is always to allow suffering to speak. And a love of goodness that keeps track of evil, of undeserved suffering and unwarranted pain. 244 years of social death, of slavery. That's race matters. That's where it begins in the modern U.S. history. Against the law for black people to learn how to read and write. Against the law for black people to worship God without white supervision in the beacon of religious liberty. That's just not a tension between practices and principles. That is sheer mendacity, hypocrisy, and criminality. We got to call it for what it is. And then Jim Crow, a civic death of terror and trauma, and every 2.5 days for 50 years, some black body swinging from some tree that Billie Holiday sang about with such power and strange fruits. Then after Jim Crow, here comes Jim Crow Jr. Hyper incarceration regime, massive unemployment and underemployment, decrepit schools, indecent housing, guns and drugs shot through working class and poor neighborhoods, disproportionately chocolate, black, brown, and red, but deeply affecting our white brothers and sisters too, and even our fellow conservative, libertarian, crypto-reactionary brother Charles Murray tells the truth in Coming Apart, that our white brothers and sisters in Appalachia, who are as precious like anybody else, catching hell, given the predatory capitalist civilization in which they find themselves. Spiritual blackout. The rewarding of callousness and the encouragement of indifference. The great Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel used to say, indifference to evil is more evil than evil itself. Indifference to evil. You create whole ways of life that generate an indifference toward people who are suffering. Now, of course, we could begin to talk about the tax bill. We can begin to talk about Trump's public policies and the ways in which it reinforces callousness, reinforces indifference, reinforces grotesque wealth inequality, turns its back on the weak and the vulnerable. But we're trying to deal first with ourselves before we engage in the critique of others. It's too easy to jump to name-calling and finger-pointing, given the example of a Donald Trump, who is a sign and a symptom of an American empire shot through with callousness and indifference, with mendacity and criminality. All spectacle, no substance. All greed and appetite, no wisdom and maturity. You see, obsessed with the fetishes, the idols of our day, which are what? Smartness, riches, and bombs. You can call it neoliberal soulcraft. It's no accident Donald Trump has got to be the smartest and the richest everywhere he goes, which is nothing but a sign of profound insecurity, self-deception, self-deceit, and yet somehow able to convince enough of our fellow citizens that he belongs in the White House. He did win, given the Electoral College. That's not a moment for self-flagellation. That's a moment for self-reflection and self-criticism. 43% of our fellow citizens didn't even vote and don't care. 25% voted for the gangster. And I say gangster because that's an objective condition, not a subjective expression. It's a very important point. Say, oh, Brother West, why are you calling the president a gangster? That just shows your partisanship and your bias. No. Anybody who talks about grabbing a woman's private parts a gangster. Anybody that's talking about stealing somebody else's oil of another country, that's gangster activity. That's objective, empirical evidence that allows us to infer he's a gangster. He's a gangster. And I'm not saying something about him that I'm not saying about myself. I was a gangster before I met Jesus, and now I'm just a redeemed sinner with gangster proclivities. I grew up with gangsters, and there's a whole lot of gangster in me. So this is not a question of somehow pointing my finger at some alien from another planet. It's part of the civil war that's raging on inside of each and every one of us, of being cold and callous and indifferent and arrogant and haughty, looking down on the suffering of others, insensitive to the hurt of others. And the result is what? Slow emergence, stirring, and expression of neo-fascist sensibilities. The unleashing of hate and contempt. Our precious Mexican brothers and sisters, immigrants across the board, Muslims across the board, Jews. It used to be, traditionally, it was Catholics. Now you got the head of the Ku Klux Klan, David Duke. He's a Catholic. That's American upward mobility. Pretty soon there'll be a Negro running things. When I was in Charlottesville with them right up in our faces and cussing and spitting and carrying on, I saw a Negro marching with the neo-Nazis. I said, that's a confused mother. Shut your mouth. But that shows that we're all human. It's never a function of skin pigmentation. It's never a function of gender or sexual orientation. It's never a function of national identity. All of that identity, X and Y, is always undercut in terms of our humanity and what kind of choices we make in regard to what kind of virtues and vices we decide to enact before the worms get our bodies. That's a crucial challenge for each and every one of us. That's race matters in the 21st century. So it is with that tradition of critique and resistance, of which I'm just a small moment. It's the blues people. And the blues is always about catastrophe lyrically expressed. Nobody loves me but my mom, and she might be jiving too. That's the king of the blues, that's B.B. King. And that's the B-side to The Thrill Is Gone. But it's catastrophe. Well, to talk about race matters is to talk about earth matters. The Anthropocene age in which we live, in which human activity now is a fundamental feature of the capacity to bring the species to a close. And it's tied to unaccountable corporate power. It's tied to predatory capitalist orientation. It's tied to fellow citizens acting as if or denying the impending ecological catastrophe that is headed our way. That's part of our challenge. And don't think, as Martin Luther King Jr. reminded us right before he died, don't think that bombs and drone strikes dropped in Yemen, in Somalia, in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, don't also land in the United States. There's an intimate connection between butter and war, between domestic policy where we don't have enough money to deal with jobs with a living wage, don't have enough money to deal with housing, don't have enough money to deal with quality education. Why? Because out of every dollar, 53 cents already go to the military-industrial complex. You got to sustain those 4,855 military bases in 42 nations and 140 special operations of U.S. forces around the world. There's only 190-some countries in the world. A lot of people tell me, Brother West, why do you use the language of empire? America's not an empire. Check yourself. All empires don't look the same. The British Empire was different than the French, different from the Belgium, different than the German. And what does it mean to be an empire? It means, like all empires, the worst is always hubris, machismo identity, thinking that you're never accountable to your victims. But I could hear Malcolm X saying, chickens come home to roost, you know. Sooner or later, you're going to reap what you sow. And you can lose your soul by thinking that somehow those imperial policies around the world don't come back to haunt your mind, heart, and soul, your memory, when it comes to domestic policy. And that's why a prophetic fight back is so crucial. But I believe the greatest contributions of black activists has been a spiritual and moral fortitude, and by fortitude I mean the fusion of courage and magnanimity. Courage in and of itself is not enough. You can be a Nazi soldier and be courageous and still be a gangster and a thug. But when you're courageous and you have greatness of character, that's something else. That's Frederick Douglass. That's Ida B. Wells Barnett. That's A. Philip Randolph. And for them, the standard was always set by black musicians. And unfortunately, black music has been viewed as some kind of narrow form of entertainment rather than a deeper form of paideia, of soul formation, in which you're able to look hatred in the face and still love. You're able to look oppression in the face and not want to oppress others. You can look terrorism in the face and not want to terrorize others. That's what the spirituals were all about. That's what the blues all about. That's what you hear in the Ray Charles. That's what you hear in the Luther Vandross. You hear the transfiguring of suffering, wrestling with terror and trauma, and giving the world magnanimous sound. And in that sound, you are able to experience a love that connects to your human soul, even given the structures of domination which are in place. And when the black freedom tradition and the black musical tradition experiences spiritual blackout, you can rest be assured that we're at the near end of the American experiment as we understand it.
What do you mean, Brother West? Well, look at it this way. If black people had decided to terrorize white brothers and sisters the way white brothers and sisters terrorized black people, every generation had been a civil war. If black people had decided to be black versions of the Ku Klux Klan, or black versions of ISIS, or black versions of Al Qaeda, so you had black terrorist cells all over every city, there would be an authoritarian crypto-fascist America a long time ago. If black people had produced terrorists rather than Frederick Douglass, and terrorists rather than Martin Luther King Jr., and terrorists rather than Ella Baker, there would be no democratic experiment whatsoever. Let's be honest about it. That's why I tell my white brothers and sisters, when you see Negroes, you ought to just give them a standing ovation. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you for Ray Charles. Thank you for Curtis Mayfield. Thank you for Aretha Franklin. Think where you come from, why you keep producing these love warriors in the face of so much hatred. They don't fall from the sky. They come out of strong families and churches and civic associations. Where does a Muhammad Ali come from? We Christians have no monopoly on it. How come he got that kind of love? How come he's got that kind of courage and fortitude in such a way that even when he's knocking folk out, he's still got love in his heart? And when it's time to give up the belt, in the name of a refusal to engage in an American imperial war, he said, take the belt. I got a love deeper than this belt. That's the tradition I'm talking about. And without that tradition, that's the leaven in the American democratic loaf. And when you lose that, it is about over. And I'm not saying black people have any monopoly on truth or goodness or beauty. I'm just saying that we black folk in the making of the United States have disproportionately contributed to the democratic expansion owing to the spiritual fortitude and the unbelievable moral orientations of a hated and haunted and hounded people. And we didn't have to do it. Could have gone gangster. Could have gone terrorist. Could have gone with hate. Could have gone resentment. We have all of those elements in the black tradition, but the major black spokespeople, and especially the musicians, said no. Charlie Parker and Cherokee said no. Listen to this. Full of rage, but it's going to put some fire in your soul. That spiritual fortitude, as well as, in his case, artistic genius. And every jazz musician is not a genius. We know that. Where are we today? Black freedom movement in very deep trouble, with the exception of the younger generation, not just black, but across race. Sign of hope. The movement for black lives, multiracial, led disproportionately by our precious gay, lesbian, trans, queer brothers and sisters. Very different than the 60s, building on the 60s, Standing Rock, our indigenous brothers and sisters coming together, echoes of Sitting Bull, going back to Wounded Knee, immigrant movement, Mexicans and whole host of others bringing critique to bear on an indifference toward those who come across the border, and of course when they come into Texas and California, which used to be Mexico. They're coming home in a certain sense. Bring this to a close. Where are we now? Neo-fascist elites, rule of big money, big military, more and more fellow citizens feeling helpless, even hopeless. Do we have a chance, or is it too late to deal with our catastrophes, the economic catastrophe of grotesque wealth inequality and the political catastrophe of not just a dysfunctional government, but the oligarchs and the plutocrats ruling things. The distinctive feature of neoliberal soulcraft is the pose and posture as if you're so concerned about something bigger than you, but in the end, it's fundamentally about you making money, gaining access to raw power, ambition, and self-promotion. And that's true in the academy as well. It's hard in the academy these days to find folk who are fundamentally in love with the life of the mind as opposed to that next promotion, that next tenure, that next visibility. All we see is so about him is spectacle, status, position. That's the superficial things. What are you fundamentally willing to risk your life for? What kind of cost are you willing to pay? What kind of death are you willing to undergo? That's the question of any struggle for freedom. If you don't have people who can answer that question, all the rest of it is sounding brass and tinkling cymbal. And that's where we are today. And we have to remind ourselves what the Greeks would call arete, the highest levels of spiritual and moral excellence. No matter how difficult those standards are, they are still there, and that's true for any tradition. The Catholics got to deal with Dorothy Day. Jewish folk got to deal with Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. The Buddhists got to deal with bell hooks. The Hindus got to deal with Gandhi. The feminist movement has to come to terms with Muriel Rukeyser and Alice Walker. The anti-homophobic movement has to come to terms with the James Baldwins and the Audre Lordes and the Tennessee Williams and the Stephen Sondheims. They set the highest standards. What a challenge. At this point, it's a matter of trying to tell the truth, bearing witness, and in the end, not talking about hope. I think there ought to be a moratorium on talk about hope. It's been so colonized, domesticated, sanitized, and sterilized, I don't even want to hear the word anymore. I'm like Thucydides in the Million Dialogue. Hope is what? Dangerous comfort that leaves you ill-equipped and it leads towards self-destruction. That's our pagan brothers and sisters about hope. You don't get valorizing of hope until you move to Jerusalem. And I understand what Thucydides was talking about. I understand why Nietzsche fell in love with Thucydides, his deep suspicion of hope. But I'm tied to hope in terms of being a hope, being in motion, putting your body on the line, engaging in forms of soul craft, you're willing, in fact, to go to the edge of your own limits and see what's there, to step out on nothing and land on something. That's the people I come from. You see, being a hope. Curtis Mayfield says, keep on pushing. That's not an abstract dialogue on hope. That's an existential enactment and embodiment of it. So when people see you, they can see, lo and behold, there goes a truth teller. There goes a witness bearer. I learned it in Vacation Bible School. I was told if the kingdom of God is within you, then everywhere you go, you ought to leave a little heaven behind. That's not an abstract discourse about hope. That's being a hope. And do we have what it takes? Open question. Every generation has to answer that question. 1930s, it didn't look good. 1950s, hysteria, McCarthyism, it didn't look good. 1890s, Robert Barron's taking over, didn't look good. 1860s, thank God for our statue right in front of this church, Brother Charles Sumner and the others fighting, getting beat up by other congressmen, it didn't look good. So it is with us. It does not look good. Who's willing to be a hope to build on the best of the truth tellers and witness bearers of the past and present? We shall see. Thank you all so very much. Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Race Still Matters, a Cambridge Forum event being recorded live in Harvard Square with Dr. Cornel West, author of Race Matters. We are co-sponsored by the Lowell Institute, Massachusetts Cultural Council, and Friends of the Cambridge Forum. Thank you for joining us. Please do so again.